From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's interesting. Two big, high-profile trials coming at us right now. One in the East, Boston. One in the West, in Centennial, Colorado. Both are about very high-profile crimes, mass murders. The Aurora Theater shootings of 2012. The Boston Marathon bombing in 2013. Seating an impartial jury for each? A real challenge. And what does impartial mean now, anyway, when saturation media coverage is all over? This hour on Point, juries, jury duty, and justice in our media age. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Could you put aside all you've read, all you've said, and with an open mind sit in fair judgment on Boston's Dzhokhar Tsarnaev or Aurora's James Holmes? Do you think our jury system works in this age of saturation coverage? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Dzhokhar Tsarnaev faces charges related to the bombing of the Boston Marathon. Here's sound from that day, April 15th, 2013, from that moment, as people on the street and watching in their homes experienced the first bomb. And it went on. And here's police audio from the scene, Aurora, Colorado. 12 people killed, many more injured, July 2012, during a shooting at midnight showing of the movie The Dark Knight Rises, allegedly by James Holmes.
We got another person out, they shot in the leg, a female. I got people running out of the theater, they're shot in room 9.
Got two victims on the east side of the theater. I need an ambulance here quick.
I've got a child victim. I need rescue at the back door of Theater 9 now.
And we've all heard a lot about both of these and more. We'll go to Colorado in just a second. Joining me first from the Moakley Federal Courthouse in South Boston is David Boeri, senior reporter covering the Boston Marathon bombing trial for WBUR. David, thanks very much for being here.
Hi, Tom.
They're talking about now a delay in proceedings there because it's been so difficult to do what they need to do to get the jury that they need. What's going on?
That's right, and that delay is really indicative of the fact that the federal judge who's insisted that he can pick a fair and impartial jury here in Boston has overstated his ability to do so, that he's been overconfident. So now he expected to be going through 40 jurors daily here at the courthouse where they're doing something called voir dire, the individual questioning of jurors. He said he'd be doing 40 a day. We've been here a week, and we're getting to about number 70 now. So it is bogged down, and it showed just the extent of what the defense would say is prejudicial publicity here that makes it impossible for him, Tsarnaev, to get a fair trial.
They've already made their first big cut here, but even in those who made it through that first filtering, we are seeing some pretty incendiary comments come out. The defense has made these public. What have we heard, David?
Well, let me read you some of the excerpts. And this is strategic because what the defense has done here is they've released excerpts from the questionnaires that the first pool of jurors filled out. And so let me read a couple of them to you. My sister was a couple of miles from the finish line when she was stopped. She wandered aimlessly without understanding what happened to try and find her daughter who was waiting at the finish line for her. She could not stop crying. Here's another one. I work with a woman who is mother and mother-in-law to two people, her son and daughter-in-law, who both got their legs amputated. Here's another one. My friend was there and got blown up. Here's another one. My friend Al was a first responder at the finish line. His description of what happened still haunts me. These are people, Tom, that made the first cut, and they're now being questioned individually.
So here's Tsarnaev. He's got 30 charges, 17 of which carry the possibility of the death penalty. The defense wants a change of venue. They say you can't get a fair jury here. What's the judge saying at this point?
The judge has said from the start he believes that in a population of 5 million people, he can find 12 impartial jurors, fair and impartial jurors, and 6 alternates. The interesting thing, Tom, is that there is a precedent here, and it occurred in Oklahoma in 1995 after the Murrow bombings. Timothy McVeigh was facing trial there. A federal judge, Richard Matsch, said that there was no possibility whatsoever that he could get a fair trial in the entire state of Oklahoma, so that he moved it to Colorado, which was Denver, Colorado, 700 miles away. And interestingly enough, he talked about there having been this Oklahoma family theme to all the coverage that followed this. 169 people, Tom, many of them children. That, when he talks about Oklahoma family, it sounds so much like Boston Strong, the theme that arose after the bombings here. And what Richard Matsch, the federal judge, said is, the existence of prejudice is difficult to prove. Indeed, it may go unrecognized in those who are affected by it. And what we're seeing here is a whole bunch of people coming before the judge, and the judge asks, do you have any feelings or do you have any opinions? Most of them say, we think he's guilty. Most of them expressed that they could impose the death penalty. They think he should get the death penalty. And the question is, through voir dire questioning, can those people be separated from their emotions? And what the defense is saying, the emotions run deep and strong. The knowledge, the presumption of guilt runs deep and strong. 68% of the people on that initial questionnaire, those 1,371 prospective jurors, say they believe he's guilty.
We've seen those in the comments. As you said, here's another. From the questionnaires, we all know he's guilty, so quit wasting everybody's time with a jury and string him up. Does it look as though the judge will just hang in? He'll do the work until he finds a jury right there where the crime occurred in Boston and go ahead with the trial.
Well, I think he was stunned by what the defense did in essentially going public with his analysis of these numbers to make their point once again that, in fact, he cannot get a fair trial here. And so what's bogged down is you have these people coming in and they're asked, after they state their presumption of guilt or that they'd be willing to impose the death penalty, whether they can put that aside, whether they can put their opinions aside, what they know aside about the case. What I thought was particularly telling, there was a stay-at-home mom who came in as a prospective juror. She has two psychology degrees, and she said to the judge in a very charming but telling way, you know, Your Honor, you say, well, put your opinions aside, put your beliefs aside, what you know aside. You know, brains don't work that way, which is an echo of Robert Jackson, Supreme Court Justice, Attorney General way back when in the Roosevelt era. But he said, the naive assumption that prejudicial effects can be overcome by instructions to the jury, all practicing lawyers know to be an unmitigated fiction. So the judge is being challenged by those numbers here as to whether he can really do it. And the question, the defense, which is an interesting point they make, even if you do find people in that 5 billion to seat, are they representative of the overall population?
David, I've got to jump to Colorado. Thank you very much for filling us in right there.
You're welcome, Tom.
David Boeri, covering the Marathon bombing trial for WBUR. Let's go to Centennial, Colorado, and Brandon Johansson, court reporter for the Aurora Sentinel. Of course, Aurora is where the shootings happened. Brandon, thank you very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom.
Incredible number of summonses that went out. 9,000 to try and put together, what, a jury of 12 with 12 backups here. How's it going, Brandon?
It's going very slowly so far. They hope for about 250 at the morning session and the afternoon session, but each time only about 130 prospective jurors have reported to court. And then it's a very lengthy and slow process from there.
Why such a huge number of summonses? 9,000. I know only 7,000 got delivered. They must have anticipated some of that, but still 7,000 is a huge number.
Yeah, it's the biggest in the history of Colorado, that's for sure. Part of the issue here, it isn't just the expansive media coverage around this, but there were three theaters that night that were showing the movie, mm-hmm. and about 500 people in each one. So that's 1,500 people that were there in the building mm-hmm. when the shooting happened. And then, I mean, you get a couple of degrees of separation from all of them, and suddenly it seems like everybody in the county knows somebody or is connected in some way to this case.
Remind us what this jury is going to be deciding around James Holmes and this case.
Yeah, the question here is sanity. It's there's no kind of whodunit mm-hmm. aspect to this. Holmes has admitted that he was the shooter that night. So they're going to be asked to decide whether or not he was sane when he opened fire in the movie theater.
And so the issue of capital crime, does that come up or not, of the death sentence?
Yeah, they are seeking the death penalty here. So
is that one of the things they're asking about? Would you be willing to impose that?
Yes, they are asking that, and if somebody isn't willing to impose that, then they won't be seated on the jury. But we don't know yet exactly how they're asking that or what. The questionnaires are sealed, and in court yesterday we were hoping that there would be some conversation about why some jurors have been dismissed, but the prosecutor in the case, George Brockler, said he didn't want to discuss that in open court because he didn't want to give hints about how to get out of jury duty, basically. I think the word he used was roadmap. He didn't want to provide a roadmap to other jurors about how they could get out of doing this.
So you've got people, lots of people with actual ties to those who were in the theaters on the night of all the killings. Then you've got media all over the place, including, we saw this week, this report that one juror was caught apparently taking a cell phone picture of his juror questionnaire, the roadmap, as you say. Talk about media coverage. I mean, right down to, you know, personally broadcasting almost what he's being asked.
Yeah, that was very strange, especially because they didn't do anything to him, and they aren't even sure which juror it was. So they didn't even dismiss him or anything like that, because his juror number, I guess he was wearing a jacket. It was snowing that day. He was wearing a jacket over his badge. So the deputy told him, don't do that, forced him to erase it from his phone. But then they didn't get his number. So in theory, that guy could still end up on the jury, which is kind of amazing.
How long are people saying it may take to just to get a jury lined up for the Aurora trial, the Colorado case trial?
Well, May or June is when they hope to be able to have the jury seated and deliver the opening remarks. But this process where they're bringing in about 130 people twice a day, this is going to stretch well into next month. And then after that, there will be individual questioning.
So we're talking 4, 5, 6 months potentially just to get the jury seated.
Yeah. Yep. And part of it is also because it's 24 instead of 12. In talking to experts, nobody's ever heard of a jury in Colorado that had 12 jurors and 12 alternates. Usually it's 3 or 4 for kind of less high-profile cases, sometimes as many as 6, but 12 is a massive number of alternates.
All the numbers getting very big here to get juries seated in these very big, high-profile trials in our media age. Brandon Johansson at the Aurora Sentinel in Centennial, Colorado. Brandon, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about jury duty and the challenge of picking an impartial jury in big cases, from the Marathon bombing to Aurora, Colorado, and beyond in our media-saturated age. The Boston Marathon case, the Colorado case, tons of publicity. Lots of people have heard a lot of it. Here's an example. Two brothers, Paul and J.P. Norden, among the many bombing victims in Boston. Each lost a limb, suffered burns and shrapnel wounds from the second blast. And here was their mother, Liz, the other day telling ABC News what she thinks of the accused, Jokhar Tsarnaev, as jury selection got underway.
I think he's an animal. He knew when he dropped that backpack, there was kids, women, families. His intentions were to do exactly what he did.
Who hasn't heard some of that? The prosecutor in the trial of James Holmes in Colorado for the mass shooting at the movie theater in Aurora announced last year he would seek the death penalty. Friends and relatives were glad to hear it. Here was Brian Beard, a friend of one of the victims, outside the Arapahoe County Courthouse talking to the media, sharing his feelings.
I'm so happy this is happening. The only way death will receive justice when somebody murders somebody else is death. I guess you fight fire with fire. It sounds awful, but I'm tired of being so politically correct. You know, if somebody takes an eye, you can't just be like, oh, slap on the wrist. You can't.
The airwaves are full of it. How do you put together an impartial jury? Valerie Hans joins us right now from Ithaca, New York, professor at Cornell University Law School, one of the nation's leading authorities on the jury system, author of American Juries, The Verdict. She's studied jurors in the U.S. and around the world. Valerie Hans, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Is our system challenged by the amount of media and reportage that's out there these days and people's consumption of it?
Oh, no question about it. And I think the slow progress in both these cases is a great illustration. I mean, what's especially difficult in these two cases is not only the media saturation, which stretches from coast to coast, but also the kind of wrenching personal links and experiences and memories that people have in each of the jurisdictions where the judges have decided to hold the trials. So I think there are two big reasons why it's a major challenge.
So take us into that. When almost everyone has heard something or heard a lot about these cases, how is the system supposed to winnow out who could still be a good juror?
Well, we have a standard. We expect jurors who sit in a trial to be fair and impartial, to be able to decide the case on the evidence that's presented in front of them and in the courtroom, and not on things that they heard about and brought into the courtroom with them. And I think, you know, it's in cases like these, it's really a major challenge. It's virtually impossible to separate all that we have experienced in advance of entering the courtroom and what's presented in the courtroom. So the courts do what they can, use the admittedly limited tools they have to try to sort through and find the people who are going to best approximate this fair and impartial standard.
We'll get into how they do that. In this case, in both these cases, Colorado and Boston, the death penalty is an issue, and that cuts a lot of people out right off the bat, doesn't it?
It does. And, you know, capital juries are not only are they not as representative of the public as our run-of-the-mill regular juries, they also are oriented toward the prosecution because people who oppose death penalty are often more defense-oriented. And especially for the Colorado case, they tend to be more hostile to defenses like the insanity defense.
What are they asked? What are prospective jurors asked about the death penalty to decide whether they're going to stay in the pool or not?
Well, I would love to see the questionnaires, which apparently are not being released yet to the public at large. But typically, one asks in a case like one of the ones that we have before us, people are asked to, in open-ended ways, to give their general views about the death penalty, especially whether they support or oppose the death penalty, how strong their views are, and whether they can imagine if a person is convicted of first-degree murder, giving a death sentence or giving a life sentence. People who could not imagine themselves doing one of those two options are eliminated.
And as you say, in many venues, that cuts out about half of the potential jurors right there. I think in Massachusetts, it's well higher than half who wouldn't go with the death penalty. So that changes the complexion of a potential jury. Then there's the issue of ducking duty itself. People really try and scramble out of this very often. You heard the Colorado reporter talking about how the judge there is trying to make that more difficult. How does that influence the jury of one's peers that is supposed to be there?
Yeah, it always makes me upset when I hear people, you know, exchange strategies for trying to get out of jury duty, because it's a very rare opportunity to participate directly in the community. It's usually a limited time, and you're doing important duty, yeoman's duty, on behalf of everybody in your community. But I thought it was intriguing that in Colorado they don't want to give a roadmap to how to get out of serving in the jury.
Does it change the profile of juries? Is there a certain kind of potential juror who manages to slip away from doing this?
Well, I think in a case like this, the bigger challenge is trying to deal with the fact that lots of people who keep up with the news are going to know a lot about each of the cases, and trying to make sure that information that they have doesn't close their minds to whatever they might be seeing in the courtroom. So that's I think, the biggest challenge. And the other we've talked about is the fact that both of these are capital cases. That eliminates another swath of the public. So I think those are more severe than this trying to get out of jury duty, which seems to be pretty universal.
But some, I think I've heard, wonder what kind of juries we end up with. If you're not supposed to have heard too much, do we have know-nothings on these juries? I mean, who doesn't know about these cases? And if you don't, does that mean you're some kind of hermit?
Absolutely. So that can't be your standard, right? You don't want people who are simply in their own worlds and not keeping up with what's going on in their communities. I don't want those people on juries in our community. I want people who are engaged and active and thoughtful and also come from all walks of life. So it can't be the standard that we eliminate everybody who has heard anything about either of these cases. So that means the kind of slow sledding that you're seeing, especially in Boston. This is fascinating. The judge has already had to adjust the schedule because apparently he really underestimated just how much time it was going to take to plumb the kinds of reactions people have to the information that they had. I got to say, I'm happy about that. I mean, I think he's taking care in questioning. And if we're going to have a chance for a fair jury in either place, it's going to take this kind of careful questioning.
All that information out there, not to mention opinion and very hot opinion on trials, including all kinds of commentators. Nancy Grace, very hot on this front. Here she is as the trial began. This is back in 2011, that Casey Anthony trial on murder of her 2-year-old daughter, Kaylee. Just another kind of hot opinion in the air as these trials are being put together. Here's Nancy Grace on CNN telling the nation and jurors in the case, if they happen to be listening, that Casey Anthony was a liar.
And now we hear an opening statement. She's saying her father is the one that disposed of his little granddaughter's body. I just don't believe that her father, a former cop, dumped Kaylee's body out in a makeshift pet cemetery in the woods to rot. I don't believe it. That means she's lying.
So much opinion raining down on jurors and prospective jurors. Valerie Hans, please stand by at Cornell there in Ithaca. David Lane joins us right now from Denver, Colorado, criminal defense, civil rights lawyer. He's defended clients in many high-profile trials and cases, up to and including the Supreme Court, extensively traveled the country teaching how to implement the so-called Colorado method of jury selection in capital cases. He's defended 24 clients in capital cases, some 50 murder cases generally. David Lane, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Do you go into jury selection presuming that almost everybody will have heard a lot about trials that come anywhere close to the high-profile nature of these?
Well, capital cases generally in the community that they've occurred in are high-profile cases. Most people in the various communities in the counties on a capital case have heard something about the case, but not like these two cases. In these two cases, the issue becomes, as Valerie said, not have you ever heard of this or not, because everybody's heard of it. The issue that the judge is going to be dealing with in both cases is, can you put aside whatever you've heard? Can you put aside any opinions that you may have formed and try this case solely on the evidence that's presented in this courtroom? The comment was earlier made that human brains don't work that way, and I would agree with that comment, but that is the standard that both judges are going to be using.
You are most often a defense attorney here, so you want to get your client off, I guess, but fair and impartial is the standard. What kind of questioning do you find most effective in discovering who could actually do that?
Well, the Colorado method of jury selection is sort of a unique way for defense lawyers to pick a jury. It is geared almost entirely to determine what any given juror's ideas and thoughts are about the death penalty only. That's really the money question in most of these cases. So I don't care generally as a defense attorney in a capital case whether someone is a Democrat or Republican, whether they're owners or renters, what kind of car they drive, what they've got on their bumper stickers. My only concern is, what is your attitude and belief about the death penalty? And so all of my questions are generally geared toward discovering answers to that question.
But there's bigger questions of, I mean, I know that's tied right in a capital case. That's what is on the line here. But does it also help you as a defense attorney find people who are more likely to find your client innocent?
Well, there was a case that the U.S. Supreme Court decided years ago called Lockhart versus McCree. I think it's an abysmal decision by the U.S. Supreme Court. And the U.S. Supreme Court decided that for purposes of that argument, they agreed with the notion that if you have a death qualified jury, meaning people who will agree to impose a death penalty, they are, as Valerie said, more conviction prone. They are more apt to believe police testimony and disbelieve defense testimony. And the U.S. Supreme Court shrugged its shoulders and said, well, it's close enough for government work. So right out of the box, as Valerie said, you're eliminating 50% of the population. A jury of your peers includes people who don't necessarily agree with the death penalty. And studies have also shown that when you are against the death penalty, you're more likely to be a member of a minority group. You're more likely to be middle class or lower class than upper class. You're more likely to be a Democrat than a Republican. What you end up with in both of these juries are no religiously scrupled Catholics can serve on these juries because they won't impose a death penalty. You get a white conservative jury that is weighted for a conviction. And this is compounded in these two cases because these cases are going to take so long. You need economic independence to be able to serve on a jury for months and months and months. So if you live paycheck to paycheck, you have a hardship and you're going to be excused on that ground as well. So you get a jury of wealthy retirees, mostly white, mostly conservative, people who have nothing else to do for 3 or 4 months other than serve on a jury. Mm-hmm. So it is a stacked deck, not only in favor of the death penalty, it's a stacked deck in favor of a conviction.
These are high bars to reach these days, fair and impartial and a jury of one's peers. David Lane, standby in Denver. Valerie Hans in Ithaca, New York. Joshua in Watertown, New York. Josh, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
What do you think?
Well, like I said, I think that, you know, people who do stay abreast of the news, whether it's a certain channel, they do receive a biased view based off of that network reporter. It seems like the reporters are reporting on their opinions more so than the facts. And a lot of these high-profile cases, it seems like these people are already convicted in the media. You know, I'm for sort of a volunteer jury to where people, you know, volunteer to go on these high-profile cases to initiate the whittle down.
How would that help if they were volunteers, Josh? If they put their hands up and said, pick me, how would that help in the pursuit of justice?
Well, I think that, you know, there are people who do, you know, they may have strong opinions based off of, you know, the right of justice, and they want to offer a fair trial rather than those who, like you said earlier, are trying to escape or hide away from being selected for jury duty.
Volunteer jurist, step forward and put yourself up, nominate yourself to be on the jury. Joshua, I appreciate your call. One more right here. West Roxbury, Massachusetts. Karen, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I was actually summoned for the Tsarnaev trial. Ended up with an exemption because I served on a state trial earlier in the year.
Okay.
But so I spent a lot of time thinking about whether I could be an impartial juror.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I kind of would like to think that I could have been. But as you guys have been speaking about, what I really got hung up on when thinking about it was the death penalty, you know, because I'm opposed to it. And what does that mean for someone who's opposed to it to be willing to say, yes, but I could give it to someone in the right circumstance? And I feel like I partially am opposed to it because having that on my conscience just doesn't feel right to me.
But what does that mean? If you had, I suppose you indicated that and you weren't selected to go forward, but if you were on the jury and opposed to the death penalty, could you still find this young man guilty even though you would know that would mean his death?
I guess I don't think I could, you know. So what does that mean about representing the entire population?
But that's because you're against the death penalty, but you're supposed to be
a very fair juror.
Well, can I jump in here for a second?
Yes, please, David.
Yeah, having picked a lot of death penalty juries, you would be my perfect juror. It's not an automatic that if you convict, he must die. The decision whether someone who has been convicted, whether that person lives or dies, is the second phase of the trial. It's called the penalty phase. And the jury has to be unanimous in terms of deciding. All 12 jurors have to say yes, sentence him to death before he does get the death penalty. If one juror says, no, life without parole is where I'm going with this, then the sentence is life without parole. So you would pass muster had you been questioned because you could impose a death penalty under certain circumstances. Therefore, you would be what is called death qualified. You could serve on the jury. But I would love you on as a defense juror because you're not in love with the death penalty. You would have a problem imposing it. And I want people on my jury who have serious problems imposing it, even though under the right circumstances, they could do it.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about jury duty and the challenge of picking an impartial jury. In big cases, we've got some big ones on the table right now. The marathon bombing case in Boston, the Aurora, Colorado theater shooting case. And when there's so much media saturation around these cases, how do we get impartial juries? Can we get impartial juries? Of course, it's always been a subject of fascination in our society and in our system, all the way back to the famous movie 12 Angry Men, 1957, all the jurors but one are ready to convict an 18-year-old Latino accused of stabbing his father to death. Henry Fonda plays the dissenter, juror number 8, and over the course of the movie, he convinces the others, one by one, that the case is anything but open and shut. But juror number 3, played by Lee J. Cobb, is holding out.
What's the matter with you guys? You all know he's guilty. He's got to burn. You're letting him slip through our fingers.
Slip through our fingers? Are you his executioner?
I'm one of them.
Perhaps you'd like to pull the switch.
For this kid, you bet I would.
That's the Hollywood version, but it is high drama. The responsibility is great. Here's just one. Back in 09, Scott Nordstrom found guilty of killing 6 people, Phoenix, Arizona, in the course of 2 robberies. Here was the jury reading out part of the verdict and his punishment.
As to count 10, first-degree murder of Carolyn Noel, we, the jury, duly impaneled and sworn, in the above-entitled action, do upon our oaths, unanimously find that the defendant shall be sentenced to death.
David Lane is with us from Denver, criminal defense and civil rights lawyer with big history in cases there. Valerie Hans is with us from Ithaca, New York. She's at Cornell University Law School, one of the country's leading authorities on the jury system. Valerie, I guess big question, is the system still working between media glare and all the rest, issues over death penalty, the issues we've described about what it takes to get a jury of our peers, is it working?
Well, these are the kinds of cases that really test the jury system. I have a lot of confidence based on research I've done over decades that basically, we have a sound system for resolving disputes and bringing together people from the community when they represent a cross-section of the community and have an opportunity to hear evidence presented by both sides and then deliberate together in a vigorous way. I think most of the time that does work. But here we are, and I guess we'll know the answer by the end of the year. Does this work? Actually, you played one of my favorite clips from 12 Angry Men because it's a fascinating glimpse into how deliberation is one of the vehicles that we hope, anyway, will try to purge biases that people bring with them to the courtroom.
That is the deliberation between those citizens in the room.
Exactly.
Yes, you hope. Susan in Augusta, Georgia. Susan, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to share my experience as a juror. I served a jury, it's been a couple decades ago, and it was a juvenile case of an armed robbery case. And when we went back for deliberations, there were 3 of us who felt that the prosecution had not made its case and that the evidence did not support this young man being convicted of the crime. However, the other jurors disagreed. And in fact, I remember one juror telling us, well, did you see how his mother dressed? He must be guilty. The 3 of us who found that appalling basically laid out our case and told the other jurors, look, he's not guilty. We cannot convict him based on this information. And we are staying in this room until you see it our way. And that's what we did. And he was found not guilty.
So you hung in there. David Lane, is there any way to question enough in advance to filter out people who are going to judge on the basis of how a defendant's mother has dressed?
You know, that's a function of the judge allowing lawyers, both prosecutors and defense attorneys, a meaningful opportunity to question jurors. For years in the federal system, federal judges hijacked the entire ability of any of the lawyers to participate in directly questioning jurors. And it was an abysmal failure as an experiment. Judges all over the country severely limit the ability of lawyers to question jurors because they, you know, the trains have to run on time at the expense of justice more often than not. You can see these jurors if you have an opportunity to actually question them, but it's so superficial in most cases that I wish the Supreme Court would weigh in and demand meaningful voir dire on behalf of all lawyers participating.
Let's go to Richmond, Kentucky, and Tom. Tom, thank you for calling. You're on.
Hello, Tom. Thank you very much for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I've had a little bit of experience in this area, and I was wondering about the issue of having jurors who are opposed to anything less than the death penalty. You've talked about folks that won't impose the death penalty. You occasionally run across jurors that say, well, if they did a murder, they deserve to die for it.
Tom, you say so, your experience. What is your experience, and what have you learned from it?
Well, I was a prosecutor for 39 years and 1 month and retired in this past June, mm-hmm. and I've tried a number of capital cases, and I have always had the opinion that if I have a juror on there who is eager to impose the death penalty, I don't want him or her.
Why not? Because it wouldn't get justice? It might get you a conviction as a prosecutor?
I'm not in the conviction business as a prosecutor. Mm-hmm. I'm in the business of seeking justice, seeking what's fair and equitable according to the community standard for the crime that was committed. I'm not about to try to stack the deck just to get a conviction. That would be grossly unethical.
Tom, I love you as a prosecutor. That's fantastic. Valerie, is that the way of the world these days? Is Tom the represent the mainstream when it comes to prosecutors and what they want to see in a jury?
Well, I think Tom's unbelievably admirable, and go Tom. I'm
go
sorry
Tom.
You retired.
I'm going to chime in on that one also.
The one thing I'll say is the idea of somebody who would automatically give the death penalty following a conviction for first-degree murder is also not considered to be fair and impartial under the law. They're called automatic death penalty jurors, and if we can find them, they should be eliminated from the capital jury, just like the automatic opponents of the death penalty should be eliminated. But the question is finding them. And I think David Lane, when he was talking about some of the challenges of questioning jurors, the limited role that attorneys can play, was just right on. It's hard to seek out bias and seek out prejudice. And part of it is people are sometimes embarrassed to admit it, and sometimes they just don't really understand or know about how particular things have affected them and influenced them.
Valerie, so, it must be especially hard in cases like these two, the Marathon bombing, the Aurora shootings, when the numbers are so large who died or were impacted or were injured, that these are often perceived as attacks not on individuals but on the community itself from which the jurors are being drawn.
Absolutely. And I think the Boston Strong movement really captured that sense that here was a community under attack and it was going to respond, and it was going to respond in a strong and powerful way. And so if it's going to be a Boston Strong jury, we're going to find a fair and impartial jury within this Boston community, it's going to take a lot of effort.
Let's go to Nashville. And Tim. Tim, thank you for calling. You're on.
Hi, Tom. Yeah, my question has to do with mental health issues, especially in Colorado,
okay.
with many people today using medications and seeing psychiatrists and things. Will they try to find jurors who can have an understanding of mental health issues, like when we had the congresswoman who was shot by a person with mental health issues? I'm not sure what happened in that case. And in the same token, do you have to have people who understand religious issues, you know, for the trial in Boston?
That is interesting. Tim, thank you for your call. David Lane, so mental health, very much an issue in the case of James Holmes and the Aurora shootings. There's an insanity defense here in picking jurors. Can they, would they look for or look to exclude people who had their own history with, let's say, mental health issues themselves?
Well, it's very interesting. I just finished a trial in March of last year involving a not guilty by reason of insanity defense to a capital charge. And so what we had so many hot button issues in that case, two of which were, one, the death penalty, and two, do you as a juror believe in the concept of not guilty by reason of insanity? Mm-hmm. A lot of jurors believe insanity is a duck and a dodge and a way to avoid responsibility, and they think it's just a ridiculous defense. Those jurors are challenged by the defense for cause. There are two types of challenges lawyers can make. A challenge for cause means the juror is substantially impaired or unable to follow the law, and you get unlimited challenges for cause. The other is a limited number of peremptory challenges, maybe 10 or 12, depending upon the jurisdiction. You can just excuse people because you don't think they're going to be good jurors. So if you don't believe in the insanity defense, that means you're unable to follow the law, because the law says it's a real defense. So you will end up having a bunch of jurors on the Holmes case who are mental health friendly jurors. They all agree, yes, insanity is real. I'm sensitive to mental health issues, which also dovetails perfectly with his mitigation for a penalty phase, meaning he's going to try, if he gets convicted, he's got to persuade jurors, at least one juror, to take mercy upon him, likely based on his severe mental illness.
I mean, so that, all it takes is one to avoid ultimately the death penalty.
Right. Mm-hmm. That's the ultimate goal in both of these cases. I know Judy Clark very well, and I know Tammy Brady very well, both of whom are involved in these cases. Their goal is to save their client's life and protect his constitutional rights. You know, first and foremost goal, save his life.
But first, even before that, just get a jury together. And it took 9,000 summonses out to try and do that in Colorado. And it's not easy. Going to take months. Jim in Niantic, Connecticut. Jim, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. This is just a thought, and I hope I don't put everyone off on this. But if it's truly impossible to find qualified jurists, would it not be possible, especially in terrorism trials, to have a trial by a panel of judges? I hate to say this, but it worked at Nuremberg and it worked at the Japanese war crimes trials. Now, they're extraordinary examples, I realize, but these are qualified jurists who are trained to look at the law. If you can't find the jury, would that not be a possible alternative?
Jim, thanks for your call. Valerie Hans, here's, you know, readiness to toss it all out and go Nuremberg style. Forget the jury. Put three judges up there. You're our experts on jury. What do you say, Valerie?
Well, the legal answer is no. It's not if it's impossible to find a jury. You can't default to judges, a judge or other. And you know, I also want to bring up this assumption that judges are somehow above bias. I think the research that looks at judge-jury similarities and differences regularly finds that, you know, judges are human. They're human like us and like the rest of us. And so some of the issues that we're talking about really might affect judges and juries very, very similarly in terms of the impact of these really devastating mass shootings and the bombing. And so and I guess I'd also say I'd like a cross-section of the community, if we can find one that's fair and impartial, to be making decisions in these important cases. It's a statement by the community. It's a response to an assault on members of the community. And it seems to me that if we are going to take someone's life, that it is appropriate for a group from the community to make that decision, however painful it might be.
Cindy in Lake Geneva, Wisconsin. Cindy, you're on the air.
Hi, great, Tiny. I wanted to put in a final plug for the jury system and agree with Valerie. The former law professor was actually thrilled to get a summons, and I was selected for a local criminal trial, felony trial. And I was so impressed. It was truly a cross-section of the community, varying ranges in age, in experience, and education. It was fascinating. But what was most impressive was the solemnity, the seriousness, the gravitas that they showed and absolutely followed the jury instructions to the T. It was amazing to watch it in action, and it just made me even a stronger believer in its value.
Cindy, I'm so glad you called. I mean, my experience with jury duty happened to be similar. I'm sure it can be messy and difficult sometimes, but I was heartened by it. It did seem like an exercise of citizens meeting out justice and taking it very seriously when I was there. But David Lane, Valerie says if we can get a cross-section of the community to come in and exercise that function, it's great, but are we getting a cross-section? Is it working, David?
Well, as I've already said, you're going to have a skewed cross-section just on the death-qualifying issue and the length of the trial. But I've often said that the one thing that separates this country from every other country on the planet basically is the jury system. Judges, I have grumbled from time to time, are politicians in black robes at best, prosecutors in black robes at worst. We would not have a free society if we went to a professional juror system where judges decide these issues. The evidence of this is seen in a place like Alabama. In capital cases, a judge has an override ability in deciding life or death. So there are out of, you know, and I'm just summarizing, I don't know what the exact numbers are, but about 100 cases where there's been an override where a jury comes back one way and a judge overrides. Meaning in those cases, judges have overridden life recommendations from jurors in about 95% of those cases. And where a jury has come back with death, there have only been 5% overrides for life. So if you want you know, when you say it worked at Nuremberg, I guess it worked because allegedly guilty criminals were hung. You know, if that's your end result, then it works. But there is no substitute for the jury system.
It may be hard, but hang in there. You say we're going to see just how hard in Boston and in Colorado. David Lane, civil rights lawyer, criminal defense attorney out of Denver, thank you very much for being with us today, counselor.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
And Valerie Hans, professor at Cornell University Law School, author of American Juries, The Verdict. Valerie, Professor Hans, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks again.
And on go, those great big cases. There's going to be so much to watch and learn right there. Listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm on Twitter at Tom Ashbrook, NPR. On Point is produced by Nick Anderson, Catherine Brewer, Abigail Collins, Julie Jopp, Sam Gelrosen, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonis, Sarah Platt, and James Ross. With help from Araz Havan and Caitlin O'Keefe, our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thank you for joining us. This is On Point.